Crime, Wine, and Chaos contains adult language and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
How many licks does it take to get to the center of the Chaos Kids Club? I'm Amber.
I know. I'm sorry.
That's not...
No, not that.
And I'm Naomi. And this is Cry, Wine, and Chaos.
I know.
Oh, my God, sister.
Sorry, sister.
I just feel like you could have done that a little differently. That's all. I have notes. I that's all I'm saying.
All right. Well, we'll workshop that later. How are you?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, it's only been a few days since we recorded an episode together. Not much has changed. Hey, I do have one piece of great news.
Okay, great.
We finally got a new dryer today.
That is great news.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, poor Trinity was hauling our towels and stuff over to our parents' house and doing laundry over there the last couple of weeks so that we would at least have clean towels. Like with clothes, you know, it's like I don't like put a lot of stuff in the dryer. Most of my clothes I hang to dry anyway, but there's some stuff that I put in the dryer. And so with the clothes, it wasn't as big a deal because I'm already hanging most of my clothes to dry anyway. But towels, you can't like hang towels to dry.
No.
They take forever that way. That does not work. And so, yeah, no more doing that. We have a brand new working dryer. And that.
Oh, good.
It's a red letter day in the LeCaf household, let me tell you.
Well, that's worth celebrating. I love that for
Thank
you.
Thank you. Mm. What about you? What's going on with you, sis?
Well, I've got my...
Your insomnia.
I've got my London Bridge t-shirt on here.
Oh, you did that? Did you do that? We didn't talk about it?
We didn't talk about it because it was not the right vibe. You had just come back from DC. That was the vibe. That's fine. It was fucking incredible. Like, I kind of got chills walking through there. I've got a whole bunch of pictures.
Of course.
Just... amazing. Yeah, it was quite the experience.
That's awesome, sister. I love that. I'm so glad.
Thank you.
And I love your shirt.
Thank you.
What about booze? What are you drinking
yes,
tonight?
Yes, thank you for asking. I'm drinking a wine called The Vigilant. It's a Malbec from Chile.
From Chile.
Yeah, The Vigilant.
Okay. All right.
I mean, the goal is to be less vigilant as... my
Did
glass
you say less,
drain.
Less vigilant?
Less. See, I told you I'm slipping into psychosis from my insomnia.
I'm actually quite concerned.
I'm concerned.
I'm laughing, but I am concerned at the same time.
Well, this is going to be fucking interesting. I'll think about my choices while you tell me a crime story. How about that?
You know what? Deal. Deal. I'm going to tell you a crime story here. And, you know, shout out to April because, you know, she sent us that giant list of crimes that we should cover. And then she sent us another email. It was like, and another thing. And she sent like another one. Huh? I don't know if you looked at that at all.
Oh, my God. Yeah, she's so funny.
She's the best. So anyway, I found that and that's what we're doing today. We are going to do one of the stories that April sent us, which I had never heard about. So this is interesting to me and I hope you've never heard of it too, because I think it'll be interesting to you.
Okay, so, great.
I'm going to tell you about Adrian Shelley.
Okay.
Okay. Adrian Shelley was born Adrian Levine on June 24th, 1966 in Queens, New York to Sheldon Shelley Levine and Elaine Langbaum. She and her two brothers were raised on Long Island. Adrian was about 10 when she started acting at the Stage Door Manor Performing Arts Training Center. By the time she hit high school, she was acting professionally, making her debut in a production of Annie.
Oh, wow.
Adrian's stage name, Shelley, was taken from her dad, who died suddenly when Adrian was 12, which was something that affected her deeply the rest of her life.
I imagine.
Mm-hmm. After graduating high school, Adrian enrolled in Boston University, majoring in film production, but she dropped out her junior year and moved to Manhattan to try to make it in Hollywood, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Blonde, petite, doe-eyed, disarmingly emotive, as she was described in one article, Shelley found quick success along with Hal Hartley, an indie filmmaker. He cast her as the lead in his 1989 film, The Unbelievable Truth, quickly followed by his next film, Trust, in 1990. Trust was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize and the Sundance Film Festival. Trust also tied with another film for the Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award. By her late 20s, huh?
I've never heard of that movie. Have you?
Mm-mm. I'd never heard of both, either of them.
Me either. Okay.
I mean, indie films from like the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know, we were still kids. By her late 20s, Shelley had grown jaded with the expectations and rampant sexism in Hollywood. In old videos, she talks about the pressures of the industry to, quote, be fuckable, to say yes to everything, to stay hot or relevant. Quote, I think I spent a lot of my 20s as if I was in some dark adventure of some kind, not really, really feeling myself alive. And I feel like a real desire to not live my life that way anymore, she tells a camera on her 30th birthday in 1996.
Good for her.
She helped found a theater company and started writing her own material, staging her first short play in 1993. But Adrian's greatest desires were to find a life partner and to become a mother. Friends and family and everyone she worked with over the years described Adrian as cheerful and full of energy, remarkable, a unicorn, an alien, an old woman in a tiny, beautiful body, special. Like no one else you would ever meet in your life. When you were in her presence, you really felt, wow.
Ugh, an old woman in a tiny, beautiful body. That's adorable. Uh-huh. Oh my God. I love her.
Mm-hmm. Totally. So once Adrian was in the biz, right, she guest starred in a bunch of television shows like Law and Order, Oz, and Homicide: Life on the Street. She also played major roles in over 24 off-Broadway plays, most often at the Manhattan's Workhouse Theater. She also appeared in the film Factotum, starring Matt Dillon, in 2005.
Wow. Okay.
But during all that time, after those two leading roles in The Unbelievable Truth and Trust, and she was taking guest roles on the TV shows, Adrian was transitioning her career to her real passion, the thing that she had gone to college for to begin with, right? Being behind the camera. She wrote and directed I'll Take You There, released in 1999, co-starring in that film with Ally Sheedy. She won a U.S. Comedy Arts Festival Award in 2000 for that film, and an International Film Festival Award as well for Best Director.
Wow, good for her.
The following year, in 2001, Adrian met Andy Ostroy on Match.com. Andy was the CEO of a marketing firm, Bilardi Ostroy. They married the following year in 2002, and in 2003, they welcomed their daughter, Sophie. While Adrian was pregnant with Sophie, she wrote the script for her final film, Waitress. That movie you might have heard of.
Yes. This is starting to come together now. I think I have vague recollections of this story. Okay. Oh.
She would go on to direct, co-design the sets and costumes, and act in the film, which starred Carrie Russell and Nathan Fillion. Adrian and Andy had rented an apartment in the West Village in Manhattan in the Abingdon Square building that Adrian used as an office. Mm-hmm. At 9:30 a.m., the morning of November 1st, 2006, Andy dropped her off there to work for the day. But then he didn't hear from her the rest of the day, and he had a growing concern that something was up. So when he got to the building around 5:45 that evening, he asked the doorman to go up with him to check on her. And that is when they found her. Her body was hanging from a shower rod in the bathtub with a bed sheet around her neck.
Oh, no. Did she? Okay. You're going to tell me, did she have mental health issues? Like what? Or was it just, okay. No, sorry. Go ahead. You're going to tell, I need to know now. Well, no, because you said he was concerned, but you know, like if she's getting in the zone and she's working, like, was it abnormal?
Sure. I think the way that it read was that, yeah, it was abnormal not to hear from her at all during the day.
Okay. Okay.
An autopsy showed that she had died from neck compression, and even though the door was unlocked and money was missing from her wallet, the police decided that Adrian had died by suicide. And Andy was not having it.
Good.
He was not on board with this determination. There was no way Adrian would have left Sophie, and Adrian was happy. She was doing what she loved. She was in the middle of post-production on Waitress, which was her first full movie all on her own, written and directed by herself. No fucking way she killed herself. Mm-mm. Andy would not stop harassing the police about this until he got them a few days later to come back out and re-examine the bathroom. And that is when a shoe print was discovered. It was in the gypsum dust next to the toilet, and it perfectly matched shoe prints left behind in another area of the apartment building by construction workers who had been working in the building the day Adrian died.
No.
The police quickly narrowed in on a suspect, Diego Pilco, who was 19 years old and working construction for Bradford General Contractors, who had been hired to do the work on the apartment building where Adrian kept her office. Mm-hmm. Pilco was an undocumented immigrant from Ecuador. He was arrested on November 6th. That's 5 days after Adrian's murder. In 5 days, they went from suicide to arresting someone.
No shit. That's not much of an investigation.
Anyway, Pilco confessed on tape to attacking Adrian and then staging a fake suicide to cover it up.
Were there any signs of sexual assault?
Like, no, not that I did not read about any signs of sexual assault anywhere.
Just, oh, there was money missing. Okay.
So in this, yes, there was money missing from the wallet. So in this first confession, he claimed that Adrian came to where the workers were working and demanded that they be more quiet. They were too loud. Mm-hmm. And Pilco threw a hammer at her. But then he got worried that she might call authorities and he would be discovered as undocumented and be deported. So he followed Adrian back to her apartment. And just as she was getting to the doorway of her apartment, Pilco tried to grab her. She slapped him. And so he punched her in the face. He claimed that she fell to the ground, hit her head, and fell unconscious.
I have so many questions.
Pilco said that he was certain he had killed her, so he put her in the bathroom the way she was found to make it look like she had taken her own life.
Wouldn't she have markings on her face from being punched?
Yep.
Okay. And isn't it like a group of construction workers? Nobody saw this? Or
there's no indication in any of the stories I read about like where in relation to her apartment this work was going on, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like how far away that was from the actual like site of work.
Okay.
So about a year and a half later, when Pilco went to trial in 2008, he told the court a different story. Mm-hmm. He said he was coming back from his lunch break and he saw Adrian going to her apartment and she left her apartment door open. So he slipped in with the intention of stealing from her purse. Mm-hmm. When Adrian caught him in the act of stealing from her purse, she threatened to call the cops. So Pilco grabbed the phone, then covered her mouth to muffle her screaming. It seems he rendered her unconscious in this process and then wrapped the sheet around her neck and hung her in the bathroom. Again, still to make it look like she died by suicide.
Right. I mean, that version sounds more plausible, but why such a different version?
You'll never get the answer to that question.
What the fuck? Okay.
So the second version was probably closer to the truth, and it was consistent with the physical evidence. Adrian had no shoes on when she was found, and her shoes had no dust on them, which they would have had if she'd been anywhere near the construction site. Mm-hmm. Also, the medical examiner had determined that Adrienne was still alive when she was hanged. She also had no head injuries, and the cause of death was definitely the compression on her neck. Prosecutors opted to offer Pilko a plea bargain, offering the charge of first-degree manslaughter rather than charge him with murder and have a jury hear Pilko's first story and then let him go. So he was sentenced March 1st, 2008, with 25 years without parole. And because he's undocumented, upon his release, he will be deported back to Ecuador.
Jeez.
Adrian's friends and family said in court that day that they would never forgive Pilko. Andy said in part, quote, "You are nothing more than a cold-blooded killer." And he also said that he hoped he would, quote, rot in jail. He said, "Adrienne was the kindest, warmest, most loving, generous person I knew. She was incredibly smart, funny, and talented, a bright light with an infectious laugh and a huge smile that radiated inner and outer beauty. She was my best friend and the person with whom I was supposed to grow old."
This is complicated.
I have so many, like, thoughts around all of this. So it comes out after reporters go digging that Pilko had an acquaintance who Pilko told him that he still owed like 12 grand to the mule that had smuggled him into the States. And he'd been living in the basement of a building owned by Bradford General Contractors.
Interesting.
Which might explain the impetus for him to like go stealing money, I guess.
Right.
Maybe that's the implication. Another reporter spoke to a neighbor of Adrienne who said that Pilko's stare had made this neighbor feel uncomfortable when she had walked by him. Which is like, okay.
Okay.
Andy filed a lawsuit against Bradford, alleging that Adrienne would still be alive had they not hired that guy.
Is that a lawsuit that's going to stick? Anybody could do that then.
Right.
Okay.
He also filed it against the owners and management of the building. According to a New York Post article, among other allegations, the complaint stated that, quote, Pilko was an undocumented immigrant, as were his coworkers, and that it was Bradford General Contractors' interest not to have police and immigration officials called to the job site because that would have ground their work to a halt. So on July 17th, 2011, the lawsuit was dismissed by Judge Lewis York. The court determined that Andy had not established legal grounds to hold the contractor liable, writing, quote, "While this court sympathizes with Andy's losses, plaintiffs have not presented sufficient legal grounds upon which to hold Bradford liable for Pilko's vicious crime. And that there was likewise insufficient evidence presented to find that either the building's management agents or its owners had reason to believe that Pilko was a dangerous person who should not have been allowed to work at the premises in order to find them vicariously liable.
This is complicated.
I mean, it's like, it's kind of like you said, right? Like anyone could end up like killing somebody like while they're on the job. Like, how do you... What I really get from a lot of this is like, oh, you hired some dirty undocumented worker and it's your fault for doing that, that my wife is dead, right?
Right. Yeah, that's like, what I'm getting to.
Right? Like, would he have filed the lawsuit if it had been a white dude that was not undocumented?
No, because, I mean, if he's saying, like, you didn't vet your employees, like, that's the only... Yeah, I mean, nobody can vet their employees for... someone who might be murdery later. That's right? Not a thing, but you can vet your employees if they're a citizen or not.
Yeah, but like, that's it. That doesn't tell you anything about whether or not they're murderers.
I'm agreeing with you. Like, I think that was really what he was getting at was.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel great.
No. And I'm like, I don't want to judge this guy because people do all kinds of things when they're like grieving, you know? And like, he lost his wife and the mother of his child and it was, you know, horrific. And he found her and like, oh my God, I cannot imagine.
Yeah.
And also like, of course he sued like everyone and their mother, because when you file a lawsuit, you just name everybody you can possibly name and see what gets stuck, which one sticks. You know what I mean? So it's like, whatever. Right. But like, yeah, I don't like the way that was argued, but Andy did start the Adrienne Shelley Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that awards scholarships, production grants, finishing funds, and living stipends through its partnerships with academic and filmmaking institutions, NYU, Columbia University, Women in Film, IFP, AFI, Sundance Institute, Tribeca Film Institute, and the Nantucket Film Festival. One of its grant recipients, Cynthia Wade, won an Academy Award in 2008 for Freeheld, a short subject documentary that the foundation had helped fund. The foundation gave an early short film grant to Chloe Zhao, who 8 years later became the second woman in history to win the Academy Award for Best Director. As part of its annual awards, the Women Film Critics Circle gives the Adrienne Shelley Award to the film that, quote, most passionately opposes violence against women. On February 16th, 2007, the NBC crime drama series Law & Order broadcast a season 17 episode titled Melting Pot, which was a loose dramatization of Adrienne's murder. Adrienne had guest starred herself on the show in the 2000 episode High and Low. The plot of Melting Pot changes the story a bit. The murderer is actually the employer of the undocumented construction worker who's attempting to protect his lucrative business.
Okay, sure.
Adrienne's film Waitress was accepted into the 2007 Sundance Film Festival before her murder. The film was bought during the festival by Fox Searchlight Pictures for an amount between about $4 or $5 million. And the film pulled in more than $19 million at the box office. Waitress maintains a 90% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow. Have you seen it?
I've never watched it. Waitress and its cast have collectively won 5 film awards and received other nominations in various categories, including an audience award for a feature film at the Newport Beach Film Festival, where cast member Nathan Fillion received a feature film award for his role in the film, the jury prize at the Sarasota Film Festival for narrative feature, the Wyatt Award by the Southeastern Film Critics Association Awards, as well as nominations for a Humanitas Prize and an Independent Spirit Award for Best Screenplay.
Jesus.
Then Andy produced Serious Moonlight, a film written by Adrienne and directed by Hines. The film stars Meg Ryan, Timothy Hutton, Kristen Bell, and Justin Long. It premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival in April 2009 and was released later that year in December. Andy also spearheaded the establishment of a memorial to Adrienne. On August 3rd, 2009, the Adrienne Shelley Garden was dedicated on the southeast side of Abingdon Square Park at 8th Avenue and West 12th Street. It faces 15 Abingdon Square, the building where Adrienne died.
Oh, God.
The musical Waitress, based on the picture written by Adrienne, opened on August 1st, 2015 at the American Repertory Theater, which is at Harvard University. After a sold-out limited engagement, the show went to Broadway, starting in previews in March of 2016 and officially opening April 2016. The production closed on January 5th, 2020 after 33 previews and 1,544 performances.
Holy shit.
I mean, it ran for almost 4 years.
Wow.
Adrienne's murder and police investigation is dramatized in season 4, episode 2 of the ID series, The Perfect Murder. It is also dramatized in season 2, episode 15 of the Oxygen series, New York Homicide. Andy directed a documentary about Adrienne's life titled Adrienne, in which he meets and has a conversation with Diego Pilco in prison. It premiered December 1st, 2021 on HBO.
Wow. Oh my God. What?
Just for the record, I didn't watch any of these things.
Okay.
But I have an excerpt. So some of my stuff I got from this article that was basically a review of Andy's documentary film. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to end this story with a few paragraphs pulled directly from that article.
Okay.
And this is about Andy's visit. This is about Andy's visit to Pilco in prison. Over several minutes, Pilco, through a translator, recounts the steps of Shelley's death. Ostroy shares photos of Shelley, of Sophie's childhood and teenage years, memories her mother wasn't present for. The point of that interview was to get the truth of what happened that day, which I did get, Ostroy said. And also to humanize Adrienne for him, so that rather than having a lasting image in his head of this panicked woman racing toward him, calling out for the police, He sees a mother, a wife, a daughter, a sister, that he understood all the moments in the last 14 years that Adrian missed, that Sophie missed, that I missed, that everyone missed. And maybe when he goes to bed at night and lies his head down and stares at the ceiling, he thinks about that and it makes him feel something that he didn't feel before.
Mm. Oh, God. That is heartbreaking. Mm.
And that is the story of Adrian Shelley.
Okay, thanks a lot, April.
God. Yeah, thanks, April. That was a big fucking bummer. I really got a sense, like, especially in that last article and the fact that, like, you know, Andy did this documentary film that was released on HBO in 2021, which means he was working on it for probably a couple years. But, like, that means that, like, you know, 15, 16 years have gone by. Mm-hmm. And he is still so
raw.
So yes, raw. Thank you. That's the word.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Poor man. Yeah.
I know.
That is devastating. Now I want to see that movie.
Sophie was just turning or just about to turn 3 when Adrian was killed. Adrian was 40.
Wow. I was trying to do quick math when you were just going through kind of the timeline of her life. And I was thinking that that was a much later in life child, not for today's standards, but you know.
No, I think that means she would have been like 36 or 37 when Sophie was born, something like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That, and she didn't even get to live to see like that amazing accomplishment with Waitress and
watch her daughter grow up and be there for Sophie.
Yeah, all of it.
All of it.
Wow, sister, that was terrible.
And it was so random, right? It was one of those rare fucking random. It wasn't a super fan. It wasn't her husband. It wasn't an ex-boyfriend who was stalking her. It was so random.
So fucking random. Wow.
I do wonder though. I mean, this kid was like 18, 19 years old. He was an undocumented, like clearly didn't speak English because even in the documentary, like 16 years later, they, you know, to have that visit in prison, Andy had a translator with him.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, you know, like, did they have any other evidence besides the shoe print and his supposed confession?
I was thinking the same thing. And why such a different story? I don't know.
I know. I feel the same way. I don't want to upset people because I'm sure that, you know, there are people that are just like convinced. I mean, I think about somebody like Andy, who's clearly convinced, like, this is the guy and this is my justice. Right. Mm-hmm. And we've done so many stories, Amber. We are true crime fanatics. Like, we've been down these rabbit holes and like the cops get it so wrong all the time. I mean, these cops were going to call it a suicide 5 days before they picked that kid up.
I know. It just, I don't know.
It
doesn't sit right. No.
I mean, no. I'm not saying definitively like this kid didn't do it. I don't feel good about 25 years in prison with nothing but a shoe print and like a confession in Spanish.
And were they only, wait, do you know if the construction was just in like common areas or was there any reason for them to have been in that apartment?
I did not get details on that.
Hmm.
But it didn't sound like they were doing construction in their apartment. No, it sounded like they were doing construction maybe on an empty apartment or a common area, but not in Adrian's apartment.
Right.
Hmm. That's not where they were doing the work.
Hmm. I'm just wondering, even if they were doing things where they had to access electrical or plumbing or something, if they had reasons to be going inside of people's apartments for any reason, like if he could have been there on a previous day and that's why his shoe print was there. I don't know.
Oh, I hear what you're saying. Or like, was he the only one that had that shoe print? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
God, like, did this kid take the fall for somebody else because he was scared and didn't speak English and he just confessed to go along? I don't know.
I want more evidence than that. I don't like it, but
I don't like it either.
Damn, sister. Wow. Okay, well, fuck.
There you go. There you have it. Do you have some chaos for me?
I do. And again, like you and I keep like loosely having similar themes in our stories. It's almost like we're related.
Almost. This one
also has a Hollywood theme.
Oh.
So I'm going to tell you a little tale about a guy named Zach Horowitz, who also went by Zach Avery.
This sounds familiar.
Okay. All right. So Zach Horowitz grew up in Florida. Here we are, Florida.
Hi, Florida.
Florida. But he moved to Fort Wayne, Indiana in his sophomore year of high school. They are best known for the final resting place of Johnny Appleseed.
Okay.
So that's a fun fact.
You know, note about Johnny Appleseed, he ended up being like kind of vilified because he ended up playing a huge part in the reason why ultimately like Prohibition won, because he was like spreading like crab apple seeds everywhere. And the only thing you can make with crab apples is like hard apple cider. And then it turned everybody into drunks. And all the ladies were like, I hate my drunk husband. We need to outlaw booze. And that's how
That sounds like its own chaos story.
Kinda.
God.
Sorry, Johnny Appleseed. No. Where was this again?
Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Fort Wayne. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So Zach moved there his sophomore year of high school. Sort of a all-American white bread type of place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Zach's high school friend, Derek, says that Zach grew up in a really nice part of town, in a nice neighborhood, in a house that was brand new at the time. Zach and Derek played football together and they were fast friends. Another friend, Chris, was one of Zach's high school friends. He says that Zach's family was very well off. His stepdad was an executive at a computer components factory. And in addition to their family home, they also had a vacation lake house.
Fancy.
Fancy. So he is very popular at Fort Wayne Carroll High School. He's athletic and handsome and just a super fun person to be around. His senior year, he's homecoming queen. He's voted for best body.
Queen?
King.
You said the queen.
Queen. Fuck. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. I was like, get it. That's awesome. No, no judgment.
King. Sorry, king. But no. So when I heard this today, voted for best body. Do you remember? Like, that's so fucking inappropriate. But how they would do that in the yearbook, like most attractive, most likely to succeed.
I got one of those awards my senior year.
What was it?
I still have it, actually. Well, because, you know, they always do like a boy and a girl for each category. So mm-hmm. I don't know who the boy was in this category. I got voted best strut.
Oh, yeah. That's true, though. That's true.
I remember thinking at the time, because I was like 17 and I was like, what? People are watching me walk? Like, what? Yeah,
I guess. I mean, when you see it coming, you can't, you have to.
Mm-hmm.
But it is so inappropriate to be grading children.
Well, we had a whole plethora of categories, right? Because there's like most likely to succeed and most likely to become president or whatever, right? Like there's a whole bunch of women there. Mm-hmm. There is definitely like most attractive or hottest or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, there's like a whole bunch of different things. I guarantee you all the high schools still do this shit.
It's gross. Well, anyway, he got voted best body.
Which, that's gross to me.
Yeah, that is gross.
Like, so, funniest, like, you know, class clown, whatever. Like, there's lots mm-hmm. of those that are like, it's fine. But yeah, when you're talking about, like, children,
mm-hmm.
voting, like, a best body is really gross.
It is very gross. Mm-hmm. I hate
it's gross. Okay, anyway, so he got best body and he was prom king, not queen.
Yeah, no, I mean, although whatever. So
he's got like everything. He's got the fancy house, he's got the successful family, he's an athlete, he's a smarty pants, he's good looking, he's mm-hmm. everything. Got it. Mm-hmm.
Yep, he's everything. After graduating high school in 2005, he goes to Indiana University in Bloomington and majors in psychology. He had initially said that he was going to go on to grad school for psychology, but instead he opens up a restaurant in Chicago.
That's a like a hard left he just took.
Yeah, hard left. He had
he's used... so good at, he's so good at everything. He's just going to be like a restaurant owner now. Like he could just do that. What did his parents help? His parents helped him out with that. His dad had good money.
He used his inheritance from his stepdad passing away to open the restaurant.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The restaurant is called Fuel, and it promotes a healthy lifestyle and even employs an on-site nutritionist.
This has the makings of an MLM, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. So
let's package that Fuel right up into sexy designed bottles with a catchy fucking logo and get all your friends to buy it from you. And you get to take a cut, and I'll take a cut, and then I'll take a cut, and then the pyramid at the top will all be rich.
Oh, God. Well, I guess I don't need to finish my story.
Oh, my God. Are you serious?
The end. Follow us on all the socials. This is chaotic. God. Okay. So. So he gets his good friends involved. Chris doesn't invest financially, but Zach does bring him on board as like the marketing guy. And he tells his friends that Howard Schultz of Starbucks is interested in his restaurant concept.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He even said that Howard's investment group called Maverin is considering investing. So his friends are all thinking they're about to get into some major fucking money, but after only a few months, the restaurant closes, and Zach tells his friends that the restaurant closed because of a shady money manager. Not him, but some other shady money
manager. Some other random dude. Okay.
Yep. So on New Year's Day 2012, Zach and his girlfriend moved to California, where Zach decides he's going to pursue his dreams of becoming an actor.
Okay.
So we've gone from psychology to restaurant owner to actor.
This kid.
Mm-hmm. And his friends are supportive but confused because Zach has never acted a day before in his life and he's never expressed any interest in it.
Okay, Joey, but if you go. I owned a body shop. Now I'm going to go to Hollywood for my acting career.
Oh my God. Right?
The age of like 40. Okay.
So he gets to California and he starts going out on auditions for TV and film. He starts going by the name Zach Avery and he gets a few small gigs, but nothing significant. So then he starts going on any YouTube channel or podcast that will have him so that he can hype up his career and get his name out there, you know, trying to get some traction. And on these shows, he is telling all kinds of tall tales about his journey to Hollywood to make it sound interesting, right?
Is he also a grizzly bear expert?
Oh, and he's Australian. Mm-hmm. He's got an Australian accent for no reason. He's got a grizzly friend named Wendy. Yeah. Oh my God.
Why do these people always have like the same vibe? They always have the same vibe.
No, well, this vibe is very, if the Firefest guy was very attractive.
Right. No, yeah, no, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the vibe. Mm-hmm. So he's on the YouTubes and the podcast, like talking about his journey. He said that he played football for Indiana University and that he was on his way to the NFL, but he sustained an injury that ended his football career.
Lie.
He never played football in college. And his friends were like, we would sometimes like, pass the football like at lunch in college. He played football in high school. In 2012, he tells his friends that he landed a role in the movie Fury starring Brad Pitt. And technically he was in the movie for half a second as an extra. He played a soldier that he was standing in a sea of soldiers and the camera panned across him for a second.
Good for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. He then forms a friendship with a couple of aspiring filmmakers, Diego and Julio, and they joined forces. And in 2013, they start a company called One in a Million Productions.
Mm-hmm.
because this name came from Zach's favorite saying, which is, quote, when the odds are one in a million, be that one. That should be embroidered on a pillow. Okay.
Good vibes only, guys. Good vibes only.
Good vibes. Oh, my God. You know what? Okay. Total side note. You remember when we were little, mom and dad had those pillowcase sets and it said, I have a headache on the lady one. And the husband said, I have an aspirin.
Yes.
I only just realized recently that that was like a sexual innuendo.
We just now got that?
Oh, yeah. Little me was like, oh, she has a headache. But if I recall, he had like a wink, wink face. Like, oh, I can take care of that. I just now got that, like recently.
Oh, sister.
Oh, my God.
This, it's been, you know, working. What? It's been working on a window in the background of your brain for like the last 40 years.
It has. Like, what a weird thing to put on pillows. Like, I have a cough. I have Dimetapp. Okay. Like, why is that on a pillow?
I cannot with you sometimes.
You know what? Fuck my life.
So cute.
I told you, I'm slipping into a sleep shortage neuroses. Okay.
It's fine. It's fine. I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah. So when the odds are one in a million, be the one. So his plan was to be able to get acting parts in the movies that his company was producing. So it's like, obviously, I can't get anything big, so I'm going to make my own movies so I can be in them.
Yes.
Yeah. So the first film produced by One in a Million is a 20-minute short called The Laughing Man. And Zach plays the main character, who is this dude locked in a mental health hospital, aka the Laughing Man. And he's seeking revenge on the doctor that put him there or something.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's this really funny guy in this little documentary I was watching, a film critic, Emmanuel Noisette, who says that it looks like Zach like really believed that he was crushing it in the movie. Like, he was like, I'm fucking crushing it. It is like a 20 minute short that is like B movie.
Mm-hmm. Available on YouTube.
Yeah. So it's during this time that the sort of landscape of the movie industry is changing quite a bit, and everything starts shifting towards streaming services. Right.
Right.
And the largest company in this arena is Netflix. And so Zach wants in on this action. So in late 2013, he starts another company called One in a Million Capital. And rather than production, this company focuses on film distribution. So he does this with the hopes that he can like feed the streamers. He tells people that he struck a deal with Netflix. He tells potential investors that One in a Million Capital plans on purchasing the rights to several low budget movies that will then give him the distribution rights. And so he puts together like this glossy portfolio of all these B and C level movie titles, like the what would be the DVD cover for investors to look at.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he says, you know, right now we're solely distributing in South America.
Sure.
Which of course makes it impossible for investors to really, or difficult for them to check and see if any of these movies are actually streaming in South America.
Right.
Because he doesn't currently have the funding to purchase any of these films. So he starts hitting up his old friends.
Yeah.
And his friends who are still back home in the Midwest, they believe that like their friend is fucking crushing it in Hollywood. Because he's posting on social media that he's starring in movies with Brad Pitt and that he's struck a deal with Netflix. He's even like posting himself flying to film festivals on private jets and like all this crazy shit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he heads on back to Fort Wayne, Indiana to hit up his friends looking for investors. And what he does is he writes promissory notes with a 45% return. So after he successfully distributes the film, they'll get a 45% return.
Stop it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not.
Okay. Well, let's just hold on here. Hold on. So after a year, an annual report goes out stating that the business is thriving, all is going well. And as far as his friends know, it's all good. They did receive their money back with the 45% initially after the first year. So he goes back to his friends and four of them start up a new company called JJMT Capital.
Okay.
And this is the first letters of each friend's name, Jake, Joe, Matt. And are you familiar with this?
No, I just, I figured that.
Oh, well, I just now figured out a 20-year-old pillowcase. So.
Look, I knew that there was a pyramid scheme involved like 15 minutes ago. Look, I can't, you know what? I can't, it's just, my brain just works that way. I don't know what to tell you, sister.
Well, the slow skis can join me. Let's keep going. Okay. So, they get an office space. You just go ahead and take a nap. I'll keep telling the people that are still listening. So they get an office space in Chicago.
I am not going to sleep in front of you. That would just be cruel.
Turn your camera off. I know, right? It's like eating a cheeseburger and someone's on a diet. Like, oh, good for you. I bet that feels fun. Oh my God. I would be so jealous. Okay. So they get office space in Chicago, and over the next few years, they get hundreds of thousands of dollars, even actually into the millions, convincing more and more friends and family members back home to invest. Again, longtime friend Chris declines to invest after the restaurant debacle. He thought it was best not to mix business and friendship, but he does know several of their friends' parents who invested their retirement or their entire life savings.
Oh. Yeah. We got a little mini Madoff here.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Pretty soon he has hundreds of investors nationwide and he has brought in $485 million.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
What did he do with this money?
Oh, thank you for asking. He buys a house in Los Angeles with a wine cellar and a movie theater. He takes trips. He buys a yacht and several cars. He marries his girlfriend that he moved to California with at the Four Seasons in LA. And for 5 years, he is living his very best life.
What about his three like co-founders of this company? Where they living the high life too?
Everyone's living the high life. Yep. But eventually it catches up to him because investors were... not getting good on their returns. So I admittedly didn't fully understand like the mechanics of a Ponzi scheme, which is what this is. And I get it now, which like one of the FBI people was like, you know, mathematically it has to end because it requires an infinite amount of investors for it to continue to work. Right.
Yep.
Like new investors pay old investors and then new investors pay old investors. So when he gets to this $485 million and there's not new investors, like it was working up until then. He was paying people back and 45% and all the things and all the things and all the things. But that would have to go on exponentially.
He wasn't in generating any funds because he wasn't. Mm-mm. They weren't doing any work. They weren't doing the thing that they were supposedly investing in them doing.
No, they were not. Nope. So then his investors start getting emails saying that they're coming from Netflix and that things are just like on hold, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. By late 2019, of course, the inevitable happens and he's completely out of money and the Ponzi scheme is crashing down and he's unable to make good on the promissory notes and he owes over $230 million in these notes.
Whoa. That is insane amounts of money.
Yeah. So by 2020, he's in a real shitstorm and he continues to try to delay the payments to people with excuses. But then, of course, COVID happens, which actually works in his favor because he's able to use the excuse that all businesses are basically shut down at the moment, including any production. And so this gives him some time to figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Also, during this time, Warner is buying HBO And so he, which you're familiar with.
I'm so familiar with that.
Mm-hmm. And so he uses this excuse that because of that, they're having to sort of renegotiate all of the current contracts and go through each movie that HBO was streaming at the time to decide if Warner is going to take it or not. Which say, wasn't
time out. Time out. It's actually AT&T bought Time Warner. And HBO was under the umbrella of Time Warner already.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Thank
this
you.
This was Warner was screwed over just as bad as HBO was by AT&T. AT&T fucking ruined the whole entire company.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I could talk about that for like another hour. I'll let this go for now.
Okay, let it go. So anyway, he starts drafting fake correspondence that appear to be from HBO and Netflix using the names of people who actually worked there and sent it out to his investors as proof. Yeah.
The By fraud 20... on top of the fraud on top of okay. the fraud that's going on here.
I was talking to Manfriend about, because he's like, what's your story tonight? And I, how do you even sleep? I mean, I don't sleep, but how do you sleep at night knowing that you have to figure out how to come up with $230 million that people across the nation are after you? And probably it's just lies.
Probably in, you know, 1,000 thread count cotton, Egyptian cotton sheets. You know what I mean? Like, he's fine.
Oh, being rocked to sleep on his yacht. It's true. Never mind.
Fuck. I mean, at some point, you got to just start selling shit, right? Like, why isn't he selling his shit?
I don't know. But like, even like when this started, like, what's your long-term plan here?
Right.
Like, did he think that maybe that was going to happen and then it wouldn't be a lie? I mean, I don't know. I don't know. Don't know what the long-term plan was. By 2021, several of his investors, including some of his friends, are tired of his excuses. And so they bring it to the attention of the authorities. And on April 26th, 2021, he is arrested. He doesn't act surprised or even ask why he was being arrested. He's just like, yep.
Hey, good to see you. Come on in.
Yeah.
I'm looking for you.
Yeah. Right after his arrest, his wife filed for divorce because apparently she didn't realize.
She didn't know that it was all him just being a scammer?
I don't think so.
How do you live with somebody? Okay. I understand not knowing that your partner is off like murdering people because we've covered stories like that. You know, they keep that all separate, whatever. Clearly, this kid is like some kind of sociopath or something because he's got like the charm and the right. Because like, how else are you scamming that kind of money without being like a really good liar? I mean, that means that she's been sleeping next to this guy every night for years, thinking she knows this guy and he's a fucking slime ball.
Yeah, I know. I mean, if you've got that kind of money coming in, of course you're going to believe that, oh, he's succeeding.
He's successful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so he's indicted on multiple counts of security fraud, wire fraud, and aggravated identity theft. A court affidavit from the FBI dating April 2021 reads, quote, in reality, neither Zach Horowitz nor One in a Million Capital ever engaged in any email correspondence with Netflix or HBO, nor did One in a Million Capital ever have any business relationship with Netflix or HBO at all.
Like they didn't even try to have a business.
No, the whole from the very beginning that here's the films I'm buying and I'm going to distribute. It never happened. None of it. So he entered a plea of guilty on the securities fraud in exchange for the other charges being dropped. He was given a 20-year sentence. A class action lawsuit was filed against JJMT, but they claimed that they were also victims of Zach's and they had all been financially wiped out. So they were like, it sounds like.
You said they were all living high on the hog.
They were. So he was like the main guy at the top. And then he convinced JJMT to form as their main investment group, I think, to get clout that like to encourage other investors to join because like, look, I have this investment group. But they didn't know that he wasn't pitching distribution to Netflix and HBO either, according to them. I don't know if that's true or not. One of them, I think the T in JJMT dipped out and left like a few years before all this went down. So,
oh,
anyway, they were not charged. And according to them, they didn't know that they were also swindled.
Okay. I'd like to see what kind of boats they own, though.
They said they're all totally financially wiped out. Like they're fucked. I know. Okay. So that's Zach Horowitz, a.k.a. Zach Avery, and the Ponzi scheme.
You know, the whole time I was thinking, I kept thinking back to what you were saying about how he grew up and like how attractive he was and how he was like best body. He was, you know, homecoming king and, you know, he played sports or whatever. And he's that kind of guy. He's that kind of mediocre white guy who's like attractive. And so lots of life pre like adulthood was really fucking easy for him. And then he went out into the real world and realized he didn't actually have smarts or skills because he never developed any of that because everything else came so easy to him.
Right.
Right. And then he had to use what the only thing he had, which was his charm, to fucking scam people because he didn't actually have anything to offer for in exchange for money in the way of skills or services.
Right. Right.
You know,
I also think it's very interesting, like talking about how he's possibly a sociopath, that he chose to major in psychology.
I thought that too. As soon as you told me that that's what he chose to go into, I was like, that's an interesting choice for somebody who never probably like had any interest in that before. Like, why are you doing that? So that you can learn about people's psyches better so that you can better manipulate them?
Maybe. I don't know. It's very interesting. Oh, Ponzi scheme.
Sister. I mean, it sucks because, you know, none of those people are ever going to get their money back.
No.
And some of those people, it was their retirement funds.
I know.
It fucking sucks. That's so shitty. That is so shitty to do to people. But also, like, this is a lesson in, like, investing, right? Like, if it sounds too good to be true, it usually fucking is.
Right. Right.
And you should never, like, take all your fucking money and put it into something that you don't, like, that you haven't fully fucking vetted.
No.
No. You know?
I know. The thing is, like, he started with his friends and his friends' parents, his childhood friends who trusted him.
I know, which is so fucking sinister.
And like there's several of very close friends, like they majored in business and some of them were like finance guys. And so then when they were vouching for him to other people, it was like, oh, well, this guy, like one of them worked at like JP and like, so of course. That's the other thing is like their reputation was like, you fucker, like this is my career as a finance guy and I'm vouching for you. And, you know.
Yeah, but like how good were they at their jobs? I mean, all these guys were in their 20s when this happened, right?
Yeah, they were. Well, speaking of vetting your investments, I mean, join the Chaos Kid Clubs for just $5 a month.
That's an investment that you can count on. The return on your investment by being in the Chaos Kids Club for $5 a month is immeasurable, really, because you get an extra hour with us every month. And if you were in the club, then you would have been at a virtual wine night that we just had on Saturday, which you missed because you weren't in the club.
You weren't in the club, but you get in now and you can be at the next one.
And, oh, do we get to announce it now?
Yes, we get to announce it now. Dun, dun, dun.
Chaos Kids Club members have a new addition to their list of benefits, which is you guys get to hear our new episodes every week, a day before everyone else.
Dun, dun, dun. No, that wasn't it. What's the congratulations sound? Do, 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 do. I don't know. Fuck, I don't know. I need a soundboard.
I don't know how to. Yeah, we need a soundboard. Remember when Rosie used to have the soundboard at her desk? Rosie O'Donnell on her show. Mm-hmm. She had the, anyway, we do. We need a soundboard.
No button.
You have the no button, which is the first time you pushed it. I was like, "What is that?"
No. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
This is more like a yes, yes, yes.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'll get a yes button.
Great. You know what? You guys, we're on all the things, you know, Facebook, Insta, X. We're on the TikTok. I'm on the TikTok. I'm on the Twitter. I'm sorry, X, whatever. You can go find us in all the places. If you want to, you know, send us suggestions, feedback, love letters, hate mail, you send it all to the Gmail account. It's crimewineandchaos@gmail.com. Amber will read the love letters. I'll read the hate mail, and we'll probably respond no matter what. So give us a shout out. Give us a rating wherever you're listening. Give us a rating. If you're on an Apple product, go to the podcast app and write us a review. We love a review.
Love it.
Unless it's not a good one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, be honest, but
please.
Gentle. Honest, but gentle.
It just remind me.
It's like parenting, firm but kind.
No, I was just thinking of that scene in The Princess Bride when he's like, be honest, it's for posterity.
Right.
As he's just tortured him. Okay, that's all we have for you guys today. Sister, that was so chaotic.
Chaotic. Goodbye.
I love you, bye.
Love you, bye.
Wine and Chaos is produced by 8th Direction Records. Artwork by Joshua M. Davis. Music by Paul Abner. If you would like to support the show, you can visit our Patreon page at crimewineandchaos.com/Patreon. Cheers!
It's not 2019. We'll get to that.